Today we're looking at the second half of the book of Joshua. And so if you have the handout, you'll see again, I put the primary purpose of the book is to focus on the inheritance of the promised land. Yahweh, as the divine warrior, has been true to his promises that he made back in Genesis to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and has brought the Israelites through Moses and now through Joshua right to not only the threshold of the promised land, but into the promised land to conquer the land and give them this promised rest. There are actually four main parts to the book of Joshua. And we covered the first two parts last week, where Joshua is goes through a process of renewing the covenant with Moses as they enter the land. That's verses 1 through 5. And there's, in a sense, sort of a getting ready and a girding up and making sure that we're all on the same page and on the right track as we go into the conquest. And then chapters 6 through 12 describe the initial conquests of the land. And this takes place as a unified Israel. They're working as one, essentially dealing with the major difficulties under the leadership of Joshua, and there are three cities that are burned to the ground, Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. It's interesting if you ever get interested in the archaeology of these sites. There's archaeologists just like everything else. There's believing archaeologists and unbelieving archaeologists. And there's a bit of a battle and a war for ideas between the believing archaeologists and the unbelieving archaeologists. And just as in science and every other field, history, everything, there is a lot of work that is done on both sides to either find and discover proof that God didn't destroy these three cities, or God did destroy these three cities. And the interesting thing is that the archaeological record shows a burn destruction on all three of these cities, okay? What gets debated is who did it and when. And if they can establish through carbon dating and pottery fragments and these sorts of things, the when, they can either disprove or prove the destruction and the conquest. But again, all three... Archaeology has shown that all three of these major cities were destroyed by fire. Especially Hazor is an uncontested that was done by the Israelites. But Jericho and Ai are the more debated cities. The other thing that is very interesting where archaeology backs up actually the biblical claim is that there is a stele, which is an Egyptian hieroglyphic writing that dates back to the time of, I think, the 12th century B.C. I think that's the right numbers. The 1200s B.C. is the time frame. And it actually names Israel as a unified nation state. And so, of course, Egyptians never said anything bad about themselves in any of their writings, so it describes Israel as being utterly and totally destroyed. Of course, that didn't happen because else you wouldn't have had the nation of Israel. So obviously the stele was propaganda, but nevertheless, the significance of it, and nobody can dispute this, is it describes a nation state, Israel, at that time. They also archaeologically at this time, and there's no arguing with it, describe the settlement of some 250 cities by Israelites at that time, where they go from not having Israelites to having Israelites all scattered throughout the land of Canaan. And the way that you can tell an Israelite town or city from a non-Israelite town or city, do you know how you can tell? No pig bones. That's how they tell. Israelites did not eat pork. You can tell a Gentile city because Gentiles eat pork. So if there's pig bones, then it's a Canaanite or a Gentile city. Just a little trivia. You guys can just think about these things, dwell on these, meditate on them. So the second half of the book is actually describing the allotment of the promised land to the 12 tribes. And it's different from the first half in that the first half, Israel is working as a united army. In the second half, Israel is working as tribal armies. That's a very important thing to understand. United as an army, they dealt with the major issues and had these major battles. But there was still, within each region, each allotted region where the tribes would be divided up, there was still work to be done in terms of driving out the Canaanites and purifying the land and getting it to be just a pure Israelite land. And so this really is what we're turning to today, these chapter 13 through 24, the distributing of the promised land, and then at the end, the covenant renewal, having finished the conquest, or almost finished, I guess is the best way to put it, and Joshua's final act is to call Israel to a rededication of itself back again to the covenant. So chapter 12 ends with a list of 31 kings that were defeated in the conquest under Joshua's leadership. Chapter 13 then marks a transition. And so why don't you turn with me to Joshua chapter 13. And we'll just kind of see how that transition happens. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years." Wouldn't you like to hear that from the Lord? You are old. Maybe some of you are. And there remains yet very much land to possess. So here's sort of how this section is being set up. Joshua, you're kind of at the end of your time, but there's a lot of work left to do. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means, Joshua, it's really, you need to start thinking about, again, succession. And it's not going to be your responsibility to finish the job, but this unfinished work, this very much land that's left to conquer, that's going to fall to the responsibilities of other leaders. And it will fall to the responsibility of the various tribal leaders. So he lists out some of the areas which are still needing the work, the land that is left to possess. And he promises in verse 6, in the middle of the verse, "I myself," this is Yahweh speaking, "I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel." What I need you to do, Joshua, is divide it up. Allot the land to Israel for an inheritance, as I have commanded you. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance to the 9 tribes and a half of the tribe of Manasseh. Now you'll remember that, and this is from the book of Deuteronomy, that the 2.5 tribes wanted to keep the land outside of the river, or outside of Canaan, on the east side of the River Jordan. These are called the Transjordan tribes. And if you look, turn to the next page, you'll see a map. So it was Reuben, Gad, and then half Manasseh that wanted this land that was on the other side of the Jordan. And you'll remember that created a bit of a crisis for the Israelites and Moses, because it sounded like they weren't willing to go across the Jordan and conquer the land. And Moses confronted them and said, "What is this, you know, thing that you're proposing? This is not good. This is not of God. You're supposed to go into the land and conquer it." And they made a pledge and a promise that we will go across the land and we will be the front. We will fight for you. And indeed, that's exactly what they were doing. But as Joshua is allotting the various pieces of property and real estate to the various tribes, the first allotments are to just simply remember that these three have already been allotted. Okay? Does that make sense? So he lists all of these pieces of property and describes their borders and the cities that are within these. Now, even in these descriptions, you have the beginnings of some falterings on the part of the conquest, even with these two tribes and the half tribe. Notice on Joshua 13:13, and I put this in your handout. It's kind of an insignificant verse. It doesn't really stand out, but we're going to see as we go through that these kind of verses are actually quite important. Yet the people of Israel did not drive out the Geshurites or the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacath dwell in the midst of Israel to this day. Now that's not finishing the task that Yahweh had given them. They were supposed to drive these people all the way out. There was supposed to be nobody in this land except Israelites. Nobody was supposed to stay. And yet, here we see in Joshua 13:13 what was otherwise a really awesome conquest. Well, we did have that rash vow that was made, we talked about last week, where some Canaanites tricked them and they ended up getting left in the land. Here we find more faltering, more failure to do exactly what the Lord has called them to do. You remember Joshua was told at the very beginning of the book of Joshua, do not depart from the law to the left or the right. And here we see a little bit of waffling taking place in Joshua chapter 13:13. The line reveals that not all the tribes were completely faithful in their task to inherit their regions. In some ways, the line is that particular verse is thrown into an otherwise positive account of possession. In other words, pretty much it describes a successful conquest of these three areas. However, this little small failure to drive out the Geshur and Maacath will ultimately result in big problems down the road. And I think we can take a very important lesson for our own lives in this way. It's actually the little failures in the little things, the little acts of unfaithfulness, that ultimately result in the big problems in our lives. And they always seem, well, it's not that big of a deal, you know. I can do this a little bit, or you know, just try a little bit of pornography, right? Or what?
It reminds me of in the Screwtape Letters. There's a point at which the helper demon is wanting to throw this guy's sin up in front of his face and really make him, you know, see how awful he is, and you know, and the word is no, you know. It's enough that he's failing little by little. You bring it up to his face, and then it becomes a big deal, and friends rally around him, and he gets better.
Yeah.
So let the little failures just fester along the way.
Exactly. Satan would love to have us just fail just a little bit. You know, he'll get grand success in lots of areas, but just this one little faltering can create the problem. I love what Dale Ralph Davis says about this verse. He says, verse 13 seems matter-of-fact enough. Incomplete obedience usually is. It brings no immediate crisis. It seldom does. However, here is a testimony to all God's people. We frequently and strangely prove faithful in great crisis of faith, remain steadfast in severe storms, perhaps even relish the excitement of heaviest assaults. Yet we lack the tenacity, the dogged endurance, the patient plodding often required in the prosaic affairs of believing life. We are often loath to be faithful in what we regard as little. It's just little things, little acts of obedience in all the details that actually pay huge dividends in our sanctification, or little acts of unfaithfulness in the little details actually can cause big problems down the road, even though at the moment they seem, it's not that big of a deal. It's not that big of a deal if I do this or if I get away with that. But later on it produces a harvest of unrighteousness. So the very next chapter, if that is a hint in chapter 13, what we have in chapter 14 and 15 is actually an example of the right way to finish things. And that's in the person of Caleb. Caleb, of course, you remember the story of the spies in Numbers chapter 13 when they go to the land and they're sent in, one from each tribe. Caleb was the representative of Judah. And he and Joshua were the two that said, "It's a good land, let's go, we can take it, the Lord's given it into our hands." But the other members of the tribes said, "Oh, it's a good land, all right, but remember what they said, there's these descendants of the Nephilim." They were the people that were spoken about in Genesis who had mated with the demons and had created these giant descendants. So they thought they had recognized these, you know, demonic giants in the land. And they said, compared to them, we're little grasshoppers. And they said, in our own eyes and in their eyes too. We're just little grasshoppers. And so all the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron at that time, except for Joshua and Caleb. And the sentence upon that generation of Israelite is that every single one of them would perish in the wilderness, except for those two guys, Joshua and Caleb. Well, here we have the rest of that story that takes place in chapter 14. And this is one of my favorite stories in the Bible. And we'll pick it up in Joshua chapter 14, verse 6. Then the people of Judah came to Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, in Kadesh Barnea concerning you and me?" You know, he's talking to Joshua. Remember that? Remember the good old days when it was just you and me? What the Lord told us? "I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought him word again, as was in my heart. But my brothers who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Yet I wholly followed the Lord, my God." And you almost could hear him saying this, couldn't you? As this old, he's an 80-year-old man at this point. You're a tough old bird, you know? He's like, "I was 40 years old." He's meaner than ever. He's still at 80 years old. He's this tough guy. And Moses swore, this is verse 9, "And Moses swore on that day, saying, 'Surely the land on which your foot has trodden shall be an inheritance for you and for your children forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord my God.'" Now Caleb heard that promise from Moses 40 years before, and he remembered it word for word. "Moses told me that I was going to be able to inherit the land that my feet trod on." Well, where did his feet go? They went up into the hill country where the Nephilim giants were. That's where his feet went. And so there he is at 80 years old, he says, "And I'm," verse 11, "I'm still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming. So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there with their great fortified cities. And may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out, just as the Lord said." You know, "Give me that hill country, I'll take it." And Caleb goes up there and deals with the giants, the ones that made the Israelites look like grasshoppers. Now that's the kind of attitude that all the tribes should have. Isn't it interesting that most of the first generation perished in the wilderness, except for these two guys? But here in the book of Joshua, it's Joshua and Caleb, the first generation Israelites from the Exodus, who were actually the ones that finished the job. That second generation Israelites, as brave as they were and courageous as they were and as faithful as they were, had a difficult time finishing. They couldn't get the job completely and all the way done. Even in the tribe of Judah, which was Caleb's tribe, you'll see later on in the story of the allotment of their land and the boundaries are laid out. This is in chapter 15, I believe, verse 63. It says this, "But the Jebusites, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, the people of Judah, could not drive out. So the Jebusites dwell with the people of Judah at Jerusalem to this day." Caleb received his inheritance, and he completed the task. But even the members of his tribe faltered in fulfilling the job. And that's the contrast that the book of Joshua is trying to draw. That it's in the failure to finish. It's in the failure to finish that the Israelites are creating for themselves magnificent problems down the road. Huge problems. And they seem like, well, you know, we got most of it done. You know, we've captured the land. We've got the big things covered. You know, we dealt with the big areas. It's just a, you know, this tedious last little bit. Now, yeah, the last
two purposes, one's for them to get the land, and God's purpose is also to drive the others out.
Mm-hmm.
They got their half. They suddenly lost the zeal for doing God's half because they had theirs.
That's right.
I can see some parallels with that too.
Well, I think all of us can relate to the fact that it's easy to start projects, isn't it? It's hard to finish them. We've talked about this before. It's easy to start things. It's hard to finish. But it's in the finishing of things that we actually prove ourselves faithful. It's in the perseverance of the saints. It's in finishing the race. It was interesting. There was a guy in the Boston Marathon that was brought up in the news, but he was this older guy that had, you know, he had made it to the Boston. I can't remember his name. I need to find out his name. But, I mean, he was right there when the bombs went off, right at the finish line. And, you know, he's running through these explosions, and he's intentionally crossed the finish line. And they interviewed him afterwards, and he said, "I didn't work this hard to not finish." And then, you know, then he ran away. But he was going to finish. That's kind of a Caleb determination. You know, I don't care what those people are or what you think about them. God promised me. And that's the emphasis on Caleb and what gives him such strength and courage. And it says this over and over again in this section. "The word that the Lord spoke to me, that Moses spoke to me, you know, the word that I heard," everything went back to the promises of God to Caleb. He knew with certainty that the promises of Yahweh were true. God had proven that to him over and over and over again, that his word was his bond, and he could take it to the bank, and he could do anything in his power and strength. Caleb understood that perhaps better than anybody else. And the interesting thing is, Caleb was not a Jew, but he was a Kenizzite, or however you would say that. And he's an interesting exemplary member of the tribe of Judah. Now, what we find in chapter 16 and 17 is the example of what not to do. Okay, yes. He was adopted into that tribe as a, I don't know exactly how it happened, but if you you know, went through all the rite of circumcision and everything, you could be become a Jewish person by conversion.
Even at that time?
Yeah. The Lord was looking for people who would not just be circumcised of the flesh, but circumcised of the heart. Yes?
Wouldn't it be more his faith that brought him into the camp in the first place?
Exactly.
That's what Jesus is saying today. We cannot do anything without faith. And the same as Caleb, Jesus is a representation of the New Testament of new life today. If we do not speak the word, if Jesus is the word, we cannot get anything accomplished.
Exactly. Unfavoring, unwavering faith in the Word of God. That's where Caleb's strength was. That's the secret of it. And it's the same today. That's your point. It's the same today. That's the secret of unwavering strength and courage, is trusting in not our own word or the word of another person, but in the word of God. Okay, let's keep going. So what we see in 14 and 15 is this incredible example in the person of Caleb. What we see in 16 and 17 is the example of what not to do in the tribe of Joseph. Okay? And again, these are examples which, in a sense, probably sum up the positive and the negative of what they were experiencing across the land. Joshua, for as detailed as it is, doesn't actually tell the story of every single battle. It only hits some highlights to make the point. And so, unfortunately, Joseph is the negative example as they tried to conquer that area in the northern region. And so let's take a look at, you'll see up there where it says Manasseh on the right, and then there's the second Manasseh. That's the second half. Joseph had two sons, and they were to get a double portion of inheritance. This goes back to Genesis. Because of Joseph's faithfulness, in spite of his 12 brothers, Manasseh and Ephraim were to receive that double inheritance. And so Manasseh is up there, and that's one of the sons of Joseph. And then the other son of Joseph is Ephraim. Do you see that right south of Manasseh? That's actually the one tribe of Joseph. All three of those together. And again, go back to Genesis, at the end of Genesis, where you can read about that promise of the double inheritance. So what do we learn about the deviation to the right and to the left? Well, Joshua and Israel were told that the strength and courage are granted by keeping the law and the word of Yahweh, as Caleb modeled for us, not departing from it to the right or to the left. But the story, and so the story of Caleb is that bright light of uncompromising faith in the word. But what we see with Joseph is deviation from the word of Yahweh, and it will bear significant negative fruit for many years to come. But the seeds are planted here in Joshua, chapter 16, verse 10. However, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites have lived in the midst of Ephraim to this day, but have been made to do forced labor. That's not what they were called to do. They weren't called to enslave the people. They were to drive them out or to kill them, put them to the sword. But there were not supposed to be Canaanites living in that land. Even this idea of forcing them into slavery, as if that was, I don't know, some kind of mercy or compromise, that is completely out of God's will. And then the other tribe, Manasseh, yet the people of Manasseh could not take possession of those cities, but the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. Now when the people of Israel grew strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not utterly drive them out. And so we see faltering on the part of the people of Joseph. And it's interesting because the way Genesis ends, you almost sounds like Judah is not that great of a tribe. Remember, Judah was the one that fell for Tamar, and we had the kind of incestuous adultery that was taking place with Judah's tribe, or actually it was a daughter-in-law. Tamar was a daughter-in-law that she acted like a prostitute on the side of the road. Remember that story? So Judah is not presented in a really great light in the book of Genesis. It's Joseph who shines. Joseph is the man of integrity. And yet now here it's reversed. Judah is lifted up with Caleb as the shining example, even though the whole tribe of Judah faltered a little bit. Joseph really falters. And that's almost a reversal of the book of Genesis and how it lifts up these two figures. But even in the book of Genesis, there is the hint that this would happen. In the blessing of Joseph, he says to Judah that the scepter would not depart from Judah until it reaches the one to whom it belongs. And so Judah was described as a lion, and it would be from Judah that the kings of Israel would come. The resistance on the part of the people of Joseph was due primarily to their discontent with God's provision. Turn with me to chapter 17 of Joshua, and we'll see a little bit of grumbling over their portion. Joshua 17:14. Then the people of Joseph spoke to Joshua, saying, "Why have you given me but one lot and one portion as an inheritance, although I am a numerous people, since all along the Lord has blessed me?" And Joshua said to them, "Well, if you're a numerous people, well then go up by yourselves to the forest, and there clear ground for yourselves in the land of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hill country of Ephraim is too narrow for you." The people of Joseph said, "The hill country's not enough for us. Yet all the Canaanites who dwell in the plain have chariots of iron, both those in Beth Shean and its villages and those in the valley of Jezreel." What's the issue for the people of Joseph? What are they saying to Joshua? One, there's two things they're saying. One, we didn't get enough. We're not content with the provision of Yahweh for our tribe. We didn't get enough. And then when Joshua says, "Well, then go get some more. Up there in the hill country, you've got plenty of land." "Oh, well, that land is not big enough for us. And by the way, there are these Canaanites with these chariots." What's really the issue? It's an excuse. They've been given plenty. They just don't want to do the hard work of going up there and fighting those Canaanites with the chariots. Where's the attitude of Caleb here? Where's the, "Give me those hills. Descendants of the Nephilim, I don't care about them. I'm taking it." No, that's not the same kind of attitude that you're getting in the tribe of Joseph. It's a direct contrast to Caleb. Do you see it? It's not enough, and it really is enough, but we're just afraid. We're too afraid to really deal with the demons. And I think we as people of God continue to struggle with this to this day. God has given us enough. He's given us plenty. It's just a lot of times we don't like the answer. He tells us what we should do, and he says, "This is how I'm going to provide for you." But we just don't want to do the work and make the commitments and have to trust him to claim the provision that he is giving to us. And because of that, we miss out on the blessings of what he's trying to provide to us. So we get to chapter 18, and it's this new day. And what makes it a new day is that we actually have, for the first time, the tent of meeting is given a resting place. So the Ark of the Covenant is coming to a stop. Now, that doesn't mean that that the work is done. It does mean that the land lay subdued before them, and the Ark of the Covenant is going to be centralized in Shiloh. But Joshua says, this means also, though, we've got a lot of work yet to do. And he asks the rest of the tribes, "How long will you put off going in to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, gave to you?" And you start to hear something of Joshua's impatience. And so the final allotments of the land were then made to the remaining tribes. But the overarching concern is the laxity of Israel in completing the task and to be perseverers and finishers. They're called to complete the job, and so Joshua finished his part by dividing the land, but the tribes failed to finish the job of driving out the land's inhabitants. The last bit of details in the book of Joshua, chapters 20 through 22, or the beginning of 22, describe the settling in the land in accordance with the law of Moses. The cities of refuge are set up. These were cities that were places where if somebody unintentionally killed another person, they could flee and find a safe refuge so that the person who was going to avenge the blood of their loved one would not be able to strike them until they had a fair trial. So it actually created this place where a murder, an unintentional murder or an unintentional death, there could be a fair trial, and it gave some order in that respect. You also have the distribution of the cities for the tribe of Levi. They were not given a region because their inheritance was the Lord and the worship in the temple, but they still needed a place to live, so they were given cities throughout the land. And then you also then have the release of the Transjordan tribes. The two tribes and the half Manasseh were given leave. They were said, well done, you finished the job. You did complete the task. You kept your promise. You kept your vow. Now you can go back to your tents, is what it says. You can go back to your land. The last couple of chapters of chapter 22, the second half of 22 and 24, are all about keeping covenant and true covenant worship. As those tribes are going back to the land, they erect this monumental altar, a giant altar. And at first, it becomes a point of contention and crisis. And I think there's always this distrust of these eastern tribes. You know, what's with them stopping before they enter the promised land? You know, are they really going to finish the job? And every single time they prove to be faithful. That's the interesting thing about these two and a half tribes. They always prove to be faithful, but their motives are always questioned. And so here they set up this giant altar, and the other tribes go, wait a second, we knew you were idolaters. And the other tribes think that they're setting up this false place of worship. And that's totally not what they had in mind. And as the investigation unfolds, it turns out that what they were doing was actually something quite glorious. They were setting up an incredible altar that would be a witness to the glory of Yahweh and the unity of the tribes. And that they were doing this as a witness that God is the same God for both sides of the Jordan. And they were, in a sense, trying to do something that would stand as a perpetual reminder of their unity under the true worship of the one true God, Yahweh. And when all that comes out, everybody kind of breathes a big sigh of relief. But it's a very interesting point that is being made at the end of the book of Joshua. Our unity as a people rises and falls on rightful worship of the one true God. When we do that, when we worship Yahweh zealously, we will prevail. As soon as we start to set up false worship and false practices, our unity will fall apart. And that's precisely what we see as the rest of the Old Testament unfolds. The final chapters, we have Joshua renewing the covenant of Moses again, and he reads the law to him, he recounts the blessings and curses, and then we have that famous verse at the end of Joshua where he challenges the Israelites, "Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river in Egypt, and serve Yahweh. And if it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites, or those in the land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So Joshua just kind of throws down the gauntlet and draws the line in the sand and says, you're either in with the Lord or you're not. And today's the day of commitment. And they all go, we're committed. They all stand up. We're in with Yahweh. We're going to serve the Lord. Far be it from us to serve those false gods. And Joshua says, you have testified against yourself today. Your words need to now be backed up with actions. And that's where we're going to pick up next week with the book of Judges. And I can tell you this, I'll give you a little hint. It was words.